This is Hacker Public Radio, episode 3954 for Thursday, the 28th of September, 2023. Today's show is entitled, Sedating HPR at the Steeding. It is hosted by Dave Morris and is about 74 minutes long. It carries an explicit flag. The summary is, Brooks and Dave Morris have lunch and record another chat.
Okay, we should be recording. It's certainly picking up some sounds, but it does that when it's not in record mode. It is recording. Yeah, you can see that the counter is going. Okay. Okay. So, hello, everyone, and welcome to Hacker Public Radio Show. This is Dave Morris, and I have a partner in recording today sitting beside me. Hi, Mr.
Hello,
X.
Hello, it's me again, Mr. X. How are you all doing out there?
yes. I haven't quite managed to get the tension. Yeah, I guess who it is. Anyway.
So, back at Studio B.
So, yes, we've had lunch.
Oh, it was lovely.
And it was good. Yeah. I just hope I don't fall asleep.
Especially the cheesecake.
It's a warm day in Edinburgh.
Lovely. It's lovely. Really
it's
nice.
Not a clear blue sky, but it's high wispy clouds, and this part of Edinburgh is quite busy, but the car is hot, so the windows are open, so if you hear ambient noises of cars and buses and stuff going past, then well, you know, it's just the way of things.
So hot otherwise, so
we're going to do a show where we could talk about a bunch of topics. We've got lists of things, but we're not quite sure.
Yeah, I've not been very organised. I think Dave's far more organised than me. We're going to have a shared list, but I never quite came to that.
No, I didn't. So, I think I might just start then with the first one that I deliberately put to the top, and it's not really a technical thing, but I think it might be of interest. I was surprised to receive a letter from the NHS in the past week or so inviting me to organise an appointment for a vaccine. In fact, it's a double vaccine because of how old I am. I get a flu vaccine and I get a COVID-19 or SARS-CoV-2 vaccine. And the reason for this is because there's a new variant of the SARS-CoV-2 virus which has the wonderful name BA.2.86. Well, that's not its name. That's the sub-variant of the Omicron version.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've heard the little rumblings in the news, odd thing about it. And I don't know how concerned we should be. It's funny, I was speaking to a colleague the other day and he was saying, oh, yes, well, but we'll never go back into lockdown again, of course. And I said, well, that's nonsense. You might well do. I said, you know, because the thing is that if you get a very serious outbreak, if it comes to the point where your health service of a country is going to be overrun, then at that point you will have a lockdown. You have to. Well, I recall the time. Maybe I don't know if I've told this story before, but my uncle Jim, he was 90 odds when he died, and he remembered the flu outbreak, and he told me that he remembered as a small child skipping over all the coffins because there was a coffin outside every single door.
Yeah.
As a child, just skipping over them. Completely oblivious what was going on. That's what that could lead to if you do not curb things. It's not how deadly it is, it's how fast it spreads, it's the problem, isn't it? That's the thing.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. Yeah. But there is some concern that this version, or whatever you call it, I'm not sure the technical term, might be, it's not currently what they're calling a variant of concern, but they're scared that it might become and they're targeting older people, people with special needs because of immune system problems stuff.
The concern would be that it evades the vaccine or natural immunity, and at that point many people start becoming very, very ill.
Yep.
Because, of course, that's what the vaccine, people are going to remember, it doesn't stop you from getting the virus, it stops you from becoming very ill.
Yeah.
That's what it does. So
It's a disease preventer, not a.
That was a YouTube symptom. Video I was watching about an outbreak and of something, and I can't remember what it was. And back in China, was it, or somewhere like that, this is many, many, hundreds of years ago, or was it? And they used to you get pustules and used to prick, and then they would touch other, you know, other people and the villages and whatnot, and it seemed to, because they'd have a very mild form of it, mm-hmm. And it was and in the civilized parts of the world they thought this was just silly and just, you know, and it was actually a woman that picked up on this and through she was able to, I can't remember what it was, but basically she more or less discovered this, that you can the fact that you can do this sort of thing,
getting and it in a small, like,
yeah,
amount,
small amount, yeah, yeah,
means you're protected somewhat, yeah, yeah, from it,
right, yeah,
because yeah, that's how smallpox became discovered and also prevented in the early days, because mm-hmm. it's similar to mm-hmm. another pox disease called cowpox. So right. if you worked with cows a lot, right. the chances are
that's
you
right.
had cowpox,
right.
you were exposed to it, and
yep.
your immune system
yes.
would battle against it,
yep.
and it also had the wherewithal to keep off the smallpox.
Right.
So
this is it. It's,
yeah.
It's only a matter of time until something else happens. It's
well, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I'm actually
scary. So
well,
anyway,
I should tell you, because I got invited for a flu vaccination, and I thought mm-hmm. I'm thinking that obviously you want to keep the pressure off the NHS National Health Service in the UK. I thought it would be a good idea. And actually, in previous years, I was speaking to my mother about this, and she thought I had had it last year. But certainly in previous years, I had never bothered. Mm-hmm. But I got invited to this time because my mother was saying, I've not been invited, and of course she's a lot older than me. She said, how come you've been invited? But I don't know. But anyway, it was this Friday, but because I've got something on this Friday, I've actually moved the appointment on to the following Friday. Mm-hmm. So I've got nothing for COVID, obviously. So I don't always believe it's because of my age or why I've been. I don't know.
They're normally the flu shots are in October.
Mm.
So they're changing the priority for people getting the two shots at the
right.
same time or something like that. Yeah.
Right. Right.
There's a lot of information out there. I must admit, I haven't really dug very deeply into it. I just thought it was worth raising as a subject. Yeah. So yeah, did you want to? You got something you can?
I've really I've not got very much to really. I've not been any technical things. I mean, I've been on holiday a smashing time in Glasgow, and I don't know what to go with this. So I was telling Dave we went to Glasgow for a few days, and we went to a hotel called the A Point Hotel, and it was quite funky. It had like digital door entry with RFID passes, and you had your lighting, you could change the colour of it, and it had a seat that you could pull at the wall, and tables that came out, and it was very nice. We paid extra for a window view, and when we got there, there was two windows at the end of a very thin corridor that were manky, so I won't be paying for that again if I ever go back. But I must admit, it was a long time since we've been to Glasgow, and it was a nice wee refresher and change. And while we were there, we came across the Jungle Rumble, which is it's a indoors nighttime indoor putting, and so they've got like ultraviolet lights and whatnot, so your teeth all light up light, and it's quite fun.
So you get ultraviolet glowing golf ball.
Yeah,
that would be fun.
And there's different themes, like Under the Sea, that's one, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's various things like that.
That would be fun.
I wasn't sure, and then by the end of it, I thought that was really, really good. That was, they picked us up, you know, it was quite fun.
Yeah, nighttime. Yeah. Thingies,
yeah.
Events like that can be fun.
Yeah,
you just reminded me, the Edinburgh Zoo. I went to their light show a couple of years ago before the pandemic,
mm-hmm.
where they had a lantern display, and you had to sort of go in there about, it was in the early part of the year, just after Christmas, and you had to go in about 6 o'clock in the evening. It was pretty dark by then, and then walk around this thing and with all these illuminations everywhere. And there was something very, very special about that. When you saw it in the daytime, it was boring, but at night, it
just
nice.
Transformed. Wow.
These things are changed a lot that way, aren't they?
You know, also like that we also visited the London Underground. Glasgow Underground, yeah.
Yeah.
That was, I don't know if I've ever been in it before. It was, because it was so fast, you know, and it arrived every few minutes, and it just shot off like a rocket, and it was so noisy, absolutely deafening. You'd have to shout to the person next to you, and the whole carriage was, it felt like it was kind of come off the rails. It was a bit scary. So you got, this is okay, you know, but really efficient way of getting from A to B. We're a bit confused because there's an inner line and outer line, and when you got a list of the stations, I thought, oh no, we've gotten the wrong one, and we can't get to that place. And we're trying to walk backwards through all the crowds of people and trying to get to the counter to say, oh, we've got on the wrong line. And he said, no, it doesn't matter. You can get on any line. And, oh, what? No, it doesn't matter. Right. So when I got back to work out, what's going on with these things? And it turns out that you've got two lines and it's going to loop. And one goes in one direction, say clockwise, another one goes another direction, anti-clockwise. Mm-hmm. But when you get the list of stations, they maybe only give you four or five stations. So you think one line goes to one set of destinations and another one goes to different, but it's only because they're not giving you the full list. So once you realise that, and it was because, I think it was 100 odd years old, the underground, it was originally driven by a steam engine. At the end of the track, and from what I understand, and it pulled the round.
Cable driven.
So one pulled in one direction, another pulled in another direction, a bit like how it worked, San Francisco trolleys. And you've got a clutch system where you pull a lever and it clamps onto the
cable and drags you.
But of course, now they converted it to electric. And what our friend Big Clive was saying in one of his videos was that the stations are raised, so it slows you down as you come up to the station, and they obviously release the clutch and it comes to halt or whatever. But likewise, when they bring the clutch back on again, it comes down the other side, and that's why it shoots off like a rocket sort of thing. So I thought, that's clever design. And he was amazed with it, because when he got the card, he was looking for the barcode thing, you know. He said, it can't be RFID for that. And it's a paper, it's so thin, you know, and I think it's something with the cost of it and all that. And then some was, no, son, you put it on the top. And he gobsmacked it was an RFID. He tore the card to bits under the camera and showed you. That's worth watching, sort of thing.
I've been on it a long, long time ago. Yeah. I used to go to Glasgow fairly often, you know, about three or four times a year, perhaps that's how often, with the kids, because you can get a train from near where we live to Glasgow,
right,
and then get off and you know, there's loads of interesting things to see in Glasgow, and one of the highlights was to go and use the underground. It's small, isn't it? It's quite small.
Well, if you think about, that's something in Wikipedia's wonderful, and it was telling you about the history of it, and it's I think it's the third oldest underground in the subway in the world. I think, is it India's the first, and no, London's the first, India's the second, I think, and Glasgow's is third.
It's well worth a visit if you're ever in Glasgow. It's definitely a thing to go and see.
Absolutely.
You need to know where you want to go to. And
yes. And of course, I think if you do so many stops, then it becomes, you can get an all day ticket, and it's quite affordable as well. You know, so you can travel all day.
Very good. Shall I mention the fact that the Edinburgh tram system got extended? It's not on my list. I forgot to put it there. You just reminded me. The Edinburgh, some big old bikes going past it. The Edinburgh tram system got extended in the past few years. It used to run from the airport into the centre of town to a place called York Place. Now it's been extended to go down the road that leads from there called Leith Walk, which takes you to the port of Leith. and it stops there, and then, you know.
And I was speaking to a friend of ours, and he was saying that since the times I come in, you know, he feels the atmosphere of the whole place has changed, and it's much more cosmopolitan. And we've been walking the canals and whatnot, and we were talking to a bit of the River of Leith, and the last wee bit was just getting to that bit at the very bottom of Leith, and it was just last weekend we were there, and it was lovely, really nice. And you saw these trams go by and ting ting,
it was lovely. Leith is really nice. Very, very different from what it used to be.
Upmarket, definitely.
It was. When I came to Edinburgh, it wasn't regarded as a safe place to go.
Yes, indeed.
And the whole of Leith Walk with the trams on it has changed a fair bit. I think there's a bike lane that's been installed. Right. Not sure it's ready to use yet, but it will be soon. So I took the tram from near the airport out. Well, actually, I took the tram from near the airport to the airport, then got off and got on another one because I get it for free. An old geezer's card that lets me do it, and then I went all the way out to the new terminus at Newhaven, and came all the way back and parked my car at the car park outside the airport.
And we plan to do the same at some point.
It was really nice. It was really nice. It was quite a slow, leisurely thing. You could look around and. It's just nice.
And being modern and all, it'd be quite smooth and nice. Yes,
I like the fact that the sound it makes is a sort of bell like.
Yes, it's nice
electronic.
And it is electronic. Like, yes, but
it's a really bell like. Yes,
they could have picked some naff. It's really nice.
So it's good.
Very good.
So you got a thing you want to talk about?
Oh, right. Was it my turn? Is it back to me already?
Oh, no. Well, actually, no.
No,
it was
you. I thought so.
Of course, I'd just been blabbing that was my turn, but it wasn't really. It's stealing your turn. I was just going to mention the fact that I use Thunderbird.
Oh, yes. Aye, aye.
And I've been using Thunderbird for ages now, since before I retired, which is sort of the early 2000s, and it's been a pretty good mail client for a long time. Doesn't have all the features that some more fancy ones do, but it hasn't got all the anti features that stuff like Outlook has. I detest and loathe Outlook. Yeah. So I've got version 115.1.1, whatever that means, and they're actually changing the code underneath it quite a lot, and they're changing the look of it, and you don't have to use the new style interface. I'm not yet, but there is new stuff there. So the only trouble with it is that I've used Thunderbird with add-ons for a very long time. Right. So I've got things that make sounds when I get mail, and they're tunable to a given folder. So if I get a mail from Mr. X here.
You have mail. I used to get all that. It was AOL.
I want to have the tram bell or something. Anyway, so now I've had a lot of fun going and collecting free sounds and snipping them up and sticking them in as well. But that doesn't work anymore because it was written to the old API standard, and now the new API. I'm not sure that. I think that some of the add-on creators are going to be a little bit reluctant to recreate these things.
I can imagine that. It's funny. I was listening to a recent episode by Klaatu. I'm probably a good bit behind on his latest show. This is on his own show, not HPR. And he was talking about. I'm sure he was talking about Thunderbird and about mail clients and. He was ranting on about the fact that you're doing it in a web browser, like a lot of people do it through Gmail and all that, and how it hides, at the very least, it hides the header sort of thing. And you see, at the very least, it should at least save what the email address is. And I detest, particularly in Outlook, it hides the, you've got this alias. You know, who the hell bloody is that? I want to know the email address, not some daft alias.
It says Smith, John, and that's what you know.
Exactly. Well, you don't even get that. I think it'll just say.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it doesn't even give you the.
Outlook for a very long time.
I think it'll say if it's it'll say Jones Smith. But how do I know if that's Jones Smith from AOL or Jones Smith from Apple or Jones? It could be somebody. I don't know, Jones Smith, for God's sake.
I know. Yeah. I like Thunderbird. It's not the best mailer I've ever used, but it's got a lot of really good points to it. But I like the filtering capabilities quite a lot because I've got a lot of filters. I used to have a lot of mail accounts. I've got less now, but I've got Gmail and I've got others that allow me to access them through IMAP and so on and so forth.
Right.
My ISPs.
Quite sophisticated.
Mail comes in from all these sources, and then I classify them based on who they're from, what was in the subject. Sometimes, very rarely do I do that, but you know, other headers I can look at. You know, what's in such and such a header and so on and so forth.
See when it does that, does it place it in a folder or does it tag it or does it do both? Or
puts it in a folder.
Yeah, see, it's interesting because I remember I'm always worried I can't find things. So I'm just thinking from a work perspective, I get far too many emails these days and it all just goes into my inbox. And I remember a colleague having all these folders he kept things in, you know, and he said, oh, it's in, oh no, maybe put it in this one, oh no, maybe put it in that one. He couldn't find which folder it was in.
Mm.
So something like tags, you can tag all the things that are about a specific subject, but you can look at it in different directions.
Yeah.
So I think tags are very powerful.
There's pluses and minuses with that. Yeah. Absolutely, you're right. Thunderbird does have tags, but the tags are not what you're talking about, really. Mm-hmm. So you could create a tag, you know, from Fred or something, but then you're limited, I think, just to a fair degree as to what tags you can have.
Right.
It's not as flexible as just being able to add any arbitrary tag the time, you know.
I don't do any of that with any of my clients or anything. I just bung it into an inbox and that's it. If I was going to do that, I think that's how I would like to do it, is using tags and not folders. Yeah. So I'd be worried I wouldn't find something if I put it in a folder.
Well,
so.
It's got some reasonably powerful searching in Thunderbird.
Right.
And it has the concept of a virtual mailbox, which means that you can set up a search.
Uh-huh.
So you can say, okay, search all of these folders, which, you know, fit into some grouping of your own, and find stuff from so-and-so or with this in the subject or with this in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And then you save that search as what they refer to as a virtual folder.
That's like a filter. That's good. That is powerful. Yeah, that's what you want. Yes.
So you filter it. The filter is the thing you use as it comes in to make sure it goes into the right folder.
That's essentially like a tag almost. Yes, it's almost like a tag. But the same message can be filtered in different directions, different ways. Mm-hmm. That's clever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In that case, I would still just have my inbox, but have these set filters, searches, I think that's how I would do it. But there's so many different ways of doing things, of course.
Yeah, yeah. The mail system we used to use before, and I've talked about this before, and I shouldn't really go on about it, but it used, with Thunderbird, each message is in a mail box, which is a file of the four, which just contains one message after another, and it spots where one starts and ends begins with the from header that you get as part, that is the first line you get from a message. This is why if you have a message with the text in the body from here on in, it puts a greater than sign in front of it, because it wants to separate that out from the from, which is the delimiter.
Right.
It's a bit clunky.
Right.
That's interesting. It's very, very ancient.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and because of that, they've got it's an old technology, but they've got to keep running with it. They can't. That's interesting.
So
aye.
The mail system I used before had the concept of one message per file.
Right.
So what your folder, when you looked at it, was a directory, and in it were a bunch of files where the system just gave them sequential numbers.
Ah.
So you could, that gave you the advantage that you could, and there were tools that let you go to a given message and write things in the header. So you could easily say, you could add a header. The header is something which has got a piece of text, a colon, and then some more text.
Right.
So you could, and there are some predefined ones, but there's a whole range of all possibilities if you start them with an X. So X hyphen Dave's header colon, and then you put banana, then you've now tagged that thing as a banana related email.
Right.
And you could then do a search that says, go through all my emails, or go through this folder, go through this subfolder, find all banana related emails.
Wow.
And I thought that was a fantastic design and used it enormously.
Yeah.
But it's not impossible to do with Thunderbird, but not in the same way. It's you can't make up arbitrary tags, like I said. And I'm not sure they're actually stored as headers anyway. So I don't know how permanent they are, or whether they're transferable to other systems.
I vaguely remember, because did I not import, because I think I had Eudora, because it was Clatty was talking about Eudora, that was Eudora I used to use. And I think you don't, so, and then you imported that into Thunderbird, and that was not like a huge file, I think, for your mailbox. I think it was one file, I think.
Mm-hmm. There are various tools that will crunch down a bunch of individual file messages and turn them into the so-called mbox format.
Yeah.
People invented other formats after that. So I was around when mail was invented. No, not really. we started on Unix systems, and there was no email.
Yeah.
And then email became a thing, and it developed from there. And I was around at that time, so I did spend a lot of time learning about this stuff and writing stuff to hack it. But, so
I think these is for personal use. I'm okay with Gmail. It does what I want, you know.
Yeah.
But for work, I do detest Outlook. It's just.
I was supposed to be using Outlook at work, but I refused to use it, except for the sort of meeting requests and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Thunderbird can do that as well.
So.
But anyway, I rabbit on about this too much. Yeah,
No, it's fine. It's fine.
Do you want to have a go?
Yeah, what have I got next then? Let's just see. Well, the next thing on my list is ticks. Not sure if we're going to talk about that. So our four-legged companion has been, there's a few ticks recently, and he had one. One of the times he had one in his above his eye, and he managed to get out with it. There was one under his arm. It's a nightmare to get out. I think next there was another one beside that one. So there's been a bit, and I think Scotland is there's probably it's more prominent in Scotland than it is elsewhere in the country.
I
do believe that climate change is making it more.
It's making it more. Yeah, I think they're surviving easier with the change in the climate. Yeah, I know. My daughter did the Duke of Edinburgh scheme, which involves, amongst other things, doing some fairly rigorous hikes around the place. And so she, the part of the training was, to be tick aware and to if you don't go around with bare legs, because they'll jump on you, and they will get on your clothes and try and climb to an area of skin. But you need to, the members of the party do tick checks against one another, make sure at various points. It's time to stop for a tick check, and they go over the clothing.
When you hear people that what they've gone through that after being bitten, if they get what's it called? They get Lyme's disease, and it sounds horrendous. As far as I know, I've never been bitten with a tick, and I don't want to be able to bite a tick.
I've had a bite or two. A bite or two. I wasn't that well aware of how to deal with them. Certainly found them. And they're I mean, you don't know them. You don't see them, and you suddenly notice there's a thing on your leg or whatever. And from then on, I started wearing long socks with boots, and then tucking my trouser legs into the socks.
Yeah. Very wise.
And or wear gaiters or one of those sort of things. Yeah. I've always been interested in, I suppose it shouldn't be really, it's got nothing to do with Hacker Public Radio, but been interested in parasitology ever since I was doing a degree in zoology. And I listened to a podcast called This Week in Parasitism. They were talking about somebody, they do a case every month, or how often they do it. And the case is described by one of the medical members of the podcast And then it's left to be guessed as what the cause is and what steps should be taken.
Yes,
and then the next month they review it and look at all the letters they've got and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the most recent one was somebody who was in his 60s, very active, did lots of cycling, lots of walking, a little bit running and stuff, and he'd not been out of the particular state. I can't remember. It might be New York State, I'm not sure. But he was reporting that he was almost unable to walk. He was so ill that he was almost unable to stand. Mm-hmm. He came in a wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And they tracked it down to a tick bite, which had caused a thing called babesiosis, which is a bacterial infection, which I don't think is in the UK at the moment.
At the moment, yes.
No, not well, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, you know, these things spread some pretty foul stuff. There's other tick-borne diseases as well.
Yeah.
Can't remember them all. But it's not a trivial matter.
No. I remember you mentioning that podcast. Mm-hmm. I haven't had a chance to listen to it. I must do that.
It's heavy going, though, I will warn you.
All right.
My doctor friend, my son's girlfriend, I said, oh, you should listen to that. You'll find that interesting because, you know, it might be helpful in your in your work.
Mm.
And she can't take it.
It's too technical.
Is that, and also it's so horrendous.
It's also horrendous
It's a mixture of, it's way outside, you know, general practice stuff.
Yeah.
Though, you know, you might be called upon by somebody, but you'd hopefully refer them to somebody with the expertise.
Yeah. If you think about what a general practitioner's got to cope with, the huge range, and then you get these fringe extremes, you know, I'm like, how can you, it's just too much.
You have to sort of say, well, I can't classify it in any of the places that I would normally classify things, so I need to call in somebody with different expertise.
Absolutely.
And in fact, this week in parasitology thing, parasitism is one of the contributors is an infectious disease doctor, so he is the guy who gets called in hospitals so forth to give the second opinion on what the thing is, you know. So it's both fascinating and scary, also slightly repellent. Anyway, I hijacked your ticks. Yeah.
No, that's okay. No, I didn't know very much about them other than I didn't want to. I don't want anything to do with them.
No.
And of course, it's trying to hold the dog and try and get it out, and it's difficult.
Yeah.
It's actually very patient. It's surprising, you know. I mean, the new things leg way up in the air. I mean, looking kind of worried, what's going on? You know? But I had a torch and wife had the tick tool and all.
Oh,
nightmare.
Because it's important to get them out fully, not because if you just pull the abdomen, you leave the head of the mouth.
That's right.
I was aware of that when I hoiked my own one. I used a very fine pair of tweezers to get it.
Right, I see.
They're really hard to kill. They're tough as hell.
Oh, right.
You try getting one on and squashing it with your finger, you can't.
Oh, never tried
that. You need to use your thumbnail or something really hard to kill them.
We tend to stick them in a jar and then close it and keep it. Because in case, then you can...
You've got in case it's got something that might be transmissible. But they're not easy to deal with.
Yeah.
And unless you're what is it that eats them? Is like turkeys and various wildfowl. Oh, and
You mean something eats them?
I suppose
anything it's always got mostly got predators sort of things.
Mm-hmm, I think in the States it's possums, isn't it?
Oh, possums.
They will definitely de-tick you. I don't know how close you want to get to one to let it do that, but. Yeah. They will definitely eat ticks.
Right.
So, anyway, okay.
Oh, we're all ticked out now.
Ticked off, that's good.
So, I don't know whether you want to pick another subtopic or...
Well, you were talking about audacity, I think, last time we chatted.
Oh, yes, I was. Aye.
And Ahuka has done a show on the reserve queue that came up recently. We just talked about it on the community news that we recorded yesterday, talking about audacity and its ups and downs. And I spotted, or at least YouTube showed me, a video which summarizes the recent history of Audacity.
Do you know, and I think tenacity. I happened to see that, actually. I think I've seen that video. Yeah.
It's called Whatever Happened to Audacity.
Yes, there's a picture of a tombstone or something like that on it.
Yeah, I don't remember what it looks like.
Yeah.
I've put it in as a link to this this show, to the notes I've got here anyway. Uh-huh. So I don't know, it's worth posting it in the in the links when we come to put it all together. But it seems as if Audacity's doing okay now. I think Ahuka's analysis was that it's maybe improved.
I can't remember what I mean. Quite apart from the fact that they've changed the file format, and then what else happens sometimes? It was flattening my files from a multi-track one or something. And I couldn't quite work out at which point it was doing
I'm
that.
I'm not sure about that. I've not really looked into that one.
Is
that a setting maybe that was on by default where it shouldn't have been?
Don't think it's because it wasn't doing it all the time. It was much later on in the process, so it's like it's a bugger. Maybe not. Maybe it is something I've not said. Mm-hmm. And then what else was happening? There was something else happened. I can't remember now. But, I mean, generally, I somehow thought I struggle with the editing. It's not as... I find it clumsy to scroll around about and edit bits out. I can't remember whether it's the tools, they've changed the tools for selecting and cropping and clipping and so I find that much more clumsy than it used to be.
I think you can some of them have been turned off. It's like key bindings have been changed or something, I think, because I used to play through stuff in order to edit it and then use the space bar to start and stop it, I think, and that stopped working for a while. And I don't have a scroll bar anymore. I think I said this last time we talked about it, and I still haven't managed to find out how to make the scroll bar come back again.
Yeah.
But, okay. Well, the other thing I was going to say, which I hadn't even noted, because I think I just spotted it last night or something, as always, YouTube is saying, oh, you watched an Audacity video. Mm. Well, have another one. And this one was, there's a version of Audacity that seems to have been developed for the browser. That's all I remember.
Right.
I haven't got a link. Didn't think to put a link into the notes.
Right.
But I will go and find it. It might not be.
I'm not sure how that works, because I mean, is it running on a server somewhere, or how does that work?
I would imagine that it'll be some quite low level stuff running in the browser. I mean, you can do a lot with JavaScript.
Wow.
And all these new developments.
Interesting.
I mean, you can write just about anything you want as a browser plugin these days. Unless you've got really strong sandboxing and stuff
right.
to keep it away from you.
Interested to try it if nothing else. I mean, Audacity's good enough. I just find it a bit clumsy to the editing now compared to used to be better, I felt, you know. Mm-hmm. I think it's the tools. I think when you're switching between like select and some of these buttons that you clicked on to do certain things, that there's an option missing now, and I find that clumsy. Mm-hmm. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it's good enough. It's good enough, yeah.
It's that thing that I had been moaning about with Thunderbird, that they've changed it and they've tried to keep it looking the same, so you're not too shocked. However, it's doing subtly different things.
And I sometimes think that sometimes if you're getting different software people working on it, then the deep idea, the reasoning behind something's forgotten.
Yes.
Because there's certain things, for example, in Microsoft Word, I hate to bring up Word, but it was clear from the way that the things work now that the person who's changed didn't realize how this worked in the first place, because the way they're doing it now is just nuts.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't appreciate the history of it and the
reasoning behind the way it works.
So that might be the same for Audacity as well.
I think it is a possible pitfall whenever there's a change, especially when a new team comes on board and says, oh yeah, we could make this better.
Yes,
Well, I'm sure you are making it better in all sorts of fundamental ways, but you're also messing up some of the stuff that all the old hands have been using for years, and they're going to be really cheesy.
Exactly.
But I think, to be fair, people that do this sort of thing I think know to leave the doors open for people to report that. It's no longer doing that thing I've been doing for these past 17 years, and you've broken it, you know.
it's good enough. It's good enough. So I'm very glad we've still got it, you know.
So hopefully that it will gradually get back to a better state.
Mm-hmm. So I guess it's me now. So. I don't know how what we're going to say about this, but while we're on holiday, because there's a theme going here, this is what we're doing on holiday. So I had a fortnight off recently. So we visited the Edinburgh Fringe, and it's something I haven't done for many, many years. So I don't know how you actually describe the Fringe. It's a collection of artists that come along once a year and
do weird events.
Weird events and weird jokes and all kinds of weird
the
things.
The festival itself is sort of fairly managed and constrained, isn't it? You know, there's concerts, there's theatre, there's comedy.
But street performers as well.
But they're all fairly mainstream. Yep. Whereas the Fringe is a sort of lunatic fringe almost. Would you say that? I suppose so. Because, you know, you get all sorts of bizarre things, like the man who pretended he was eating his own brain with a long spoon that I went to see one time.
Did you?
Yeah. Wow. I don't know why
I went just that he fancied it.
He had this tall hat on and he kept digging the spoon down into it and coming up with some sort of grey jelly stuff, which he then ate.
It's like
as he did it, he acted losing all his mental facilities.
I wonder if he got that idea from, was it Hannibal Lecter? There's a scene from that where cut a bit and he gave it to the person that was, I'm sure that was one of Hannibal Lecter. That's this pretty fringy. Because we went to see a Michael Safar, Shafar, Shafar, and so I haven't got any details here, but from what I recall, was a solicitor or something like that, but he got testicular cancer, I think, or something like that, and sort of decided he wanted to be a comedian and sort of wrote that into his show, basically. Mm-hmm. There's bits that are a bit, you know, they're a wee bit kind of, let's say, edgy and fringy, let's say. But I've actually looked on YouTube and you bit more, if you watch if you look it up on YouTube, you'll find basically about 90% of the material that we saw, because it just, it's the same thing. So there's wee differences slightly between, and it must do it all over the world, I suppose. It was okay, it was all right.
Very good. I mean, you can get some good stuff, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. if you've got to be really selective. You've got to read through the guides.
We just turned up.
It's a little bit of a risk.
It was short term notice that we were going to go to the Fringe, and we really went for a walk around Edinburgh and go to some of the outdoor. It's funny, we looked down the high street and the street performers and stuff, and you got the feeling, I was saying to my friend, they almost seem a bit frantic. Now, maybe I'm just imagining it, but the atmosphere didn't feel the same. And I just thought, you know, maybe they're desperate. You know, it could be a bit of that as well. You know, they're short on money. I mean, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'm just getting old, and I don't know about that as well, I suppose. But
they
seemed a bit desperate. And it didn't seem to be much going on either. You know, we went up to Princess Street, and you usually get a piper on the corner. No bagpipes. My old boss hates bagpipes. The worst things on instruments ever, he says, you know.
It's often I've certainly seen some interesting musical things in the past. Mm. There was a guy playing the Chinese, what do you call it, hammered dulcimer thing.
Yeah.
Saw him in Princess Street Gardens. Right. And that, I think, it's a glorious, glorious sound. He was playing some really traditional Chinese music. Just sort of stood there in the bushes.
That, well, we were in the gardens, and they had the fountain, mm-hmm. and there was a wee area for the kids. And as far as I could tell, there was nothing else. There was nothing. You know, they've got the concert bit. There was nothing happening there. Mm-hmm. It was just people mulling about.
Okay.
What's happened? You know.
So. Yeah. So maybe. Mm. Yeah. It's expensive to get here, maybe? I don't know.
Part of it. Well, I mean, the place seemed busy enough. It's just that there wasn't very many acts. But maybe there was acts, like you say, like this comedian chap, you know, in venues rather than on the street. Maybe they weren't doing many street artists, you know.
Because the whole venue thing in Edinburgh is a little bit bizarre, because there's lots and lots of little places in corners which are
basements
venues.
And
there's big venues which will take, you know, several hundred people.
Yeah.
And then there's a little teeny tiny places, like that, which are, you know, just somebody's back room or something.
And we were in this wee room, and there was about, I don't know, 30 people maybe, something in the room, and we were at the very front rows. Basically looking up his nostrils, were that closest about, you know, just don't look at me, don't pick me, please.
Oh, that's the thing that always drove me nuts going to the I went to see, there was a musical performance called the Doug Anthony All Stars years and years back, and they were from Australia. And they played some really nice music. I can't remember what sort of style it was. It was sort of various country rock and something like that. Yeah. But I went to see them because they were, I'd been hearing them on the radio or whatever. And they're long gone, by the way. But they went really sort of nuts at one point. We were in a theatre, one of the university theatres, really fairly large capacity with the stage. And the guy starts the interaction with the audience, and people are sort of answering him back and stuff. And he suddenly jumps off the stage onto the back of the nearest seat and runs across through the audience on the backs of the seats.
God.
And he goes to the guy who just last heckled him. He said, "Get your shirt off." And the guy had to take his t-shirt off, and then he took it away and threw it away. Those sorts of things. I think I'd be up and I'd be out and running down the street. I really do not do well in those situations.
I'd be freaking out as well. No, you'd be much more laid back than that.
I mean, it must appeal to some people. The guy who had his shirt stolen didn't seem to be overly concerned about it. But he laughed along. But there's a lot. There has been a lot of that type of thing in the past. I've certainly been to places where I choose my seat carefully, so I'm not too near the aisle, because it's more likely to be called out there.
I'm
not too far back, because they said, "Well, you're hiding from us."
Yeah.
And then I sort of keep my head down, so I don't get picked, because they will pick members of the audience to come out and do stuff. And, and I really don't
know that at all. Either, I must admit.
Anyway, so you had fun. You didn't get picked on.
No.
Your shirt stolen.
Other than it seemed a bit quiet, you know. We had a lovely time. It was a nice day, and I got nice tea as well. So, it was lovely.
Good.
So
I didn't do anything with the festival fringe this year.
We normally don't do either. We've got the opportunity. We'll grab it, because it's years since I've been a child.
It's good. My son and his girlfriend went to something to a comedian, Frankie Boyle.
Oh yeah, Frankie Boyle.
That was more mainstream. Frankie Boyle. I said it was a really good evening.
Good.
Shall I mention about what's been happening on the HBR front? We haven't. I mean, we've said a bit about these things elsewhere, but I can just run through a quick summary for those who are not completely up to speed. We've moved HBR off the hosting service that was run by Josh, who owns anhonesthost.com, and he's trying to cut back on his commitments and stuff. So he set us up a virtual server on the Amazon AWS, and we've been moving stuff for several months now. I think we started in maybe late May or early June, and so it's all it's gradually been going across. And Rowan, who is with us at that point, helping us with setting stuff up, used his static site software to implement the whole site. So that's been running since mid June, I think. I might have my date slightly wrong, but never mind. We've got the static site, so all of the pages with shows are on the static site. So they they're getting refreshed daily, except not at, at weekends, because not much happens over the weekends. Okay. But you will, you know, if a comment's added, you won't see the comment being added to the show until the next day when it'll have been added, but the static site hasn't updated it. So there are some dynamic bits. So if you want to add a comment, then the dynamic bit has to work on it. If you want to submit a show, then you talk into the dynamic side of things.
Right.
Pretty much invisibly, I think. Mm-hmm. And if you go and look at the page of the calendar, as we call it, mm-hmm. which shows all the free slots and stuff
I'm going to go to first of all.
That's dynamic as well. Mm-hmm. So that's all working pretty well.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, Rowan, he became unavailable, from about mid-June. Mm-hmm. We tried to contact him and haven't managed to.
Yeah.
And we have no real idea of what's happened, whether he's ill, whether he's, I don't know. So we've had to work on getting his software, all the wrinkles out of his software, which there weren't many. I mean, it's important.
It's quite an amazing feat to do.
Yeah. He did a magnificent job. He really did. And it's really important that we say that. Don't just talk about the negatives. Yeah. There will obviously be negatives.
What was it written in?
It's written in Perl.
Wow.
He did that deliberately.
Ah.
I remember him saying to me, he said, I'm going to write it in Perl and I'm going to use the template system, which is basically a thing where you prepare a sort of web page. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be a web page, but a thing in a template form. Mm-hmm. And the template contains bits and pieces that written in a sort of a meta language that say, to fill in this bit of HTML, get this thing out of the database.
Yeah.
So in some cases, actually, calling a query on the database to get the stuff, and then it's displaying it. So with various changes and comments, not comments, but changes and reformats and stuff. So, so it's something I can maintain without too much trouble. Well, it took me a few weeks to actually get my head around the whole thing, because it's quite big. The code is, the actual script is not big, but once you look at all the templates, there's lots of them, and they interact in interesting ways. So learning how that happens has been a challenge.
Wow.
So then the other thing I've got written down is we had the HPR mailing list, which we were trying to run on the server and run mail there as well. I think we've got minimal mail running on the server. But the mail list turned out to be really difficult to set up, because the mailman version we used seemed to gobble up all the resources.
Right.
So we've actually outsourced the mail list to a paid service that Ken uses for his own mail things. So that seems to be working fine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So show upload works, comments are working, there are changes that need to be made to get it all back together again, because we have it's been a major change from one thing to another. So we've been just developing bits. I did say some stuff about this in the community news, so I'll not go on anymore. But
it's funny, but if you look at this, you would never know that anything's really changed. It just looks the same. It's I know I did briefly mention to Dave that I've got my, I've mentioned it a little before, but I've got a device, a Raspberry Pi, and it runs a Python code, and it does a number of things, but one of the things it does is when they power it on, it checks the used to be a status page that was generated, and it could query that and grab the number of shows that left in the queue. But of course, now that no longer exists, that page, so that's broken.
I think the thinking was we had free access to various dynamic things like that on the original server, but they cost,
of course.
And now we're in a situation where we want to minimize the number of calls to this server, because it's a costable service, and Josh is paying for it at the moment. We do still have APIs that do this, but they're authenticated APIs that are being used by various bits and pieces of the software. So I don't think we really want to put them out to the
But as, yeah. as I say, looking at, I mean, I've not noticed anything. I just looks fine to me, you know. But I've spent a lot of time looking at this. Did I not hear somebody mention that is there a bug tracking thing or something? Because I couldn't. When I looked at
There is. We've got Josh has provided us with a site with Git hosting on it.
Right.
Git repositories. So it's using Gitty, which is one of the free Git repository management thingies. And it's available. We've got one for the static site specifically. We've got others for the dynamic bit and various other things. And the static site stuff is available for you to go and look at and read and see the code and grab your own copy of the code and run your own instance of HPR if you really want to. Mm-hmm. So as a Git repo, one of the features that it offers is thing where you can keep a list of issues. Mm-hmm. So we do need people who want to add issues to be registered on the site, but you can just do that for now.
But I was wondering, you know, if you were planning to run the service yourself, then that would be the place, because you'd be getting the code presumably from the Git repository or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's somebody who just visits the HPR site, presumably all that they would do is if they notice something, they would just email the janitors and just say, "Well, I've noticed this, by the way."
We've had three classes of reports so far.
Mm.
We've had few using the issue tracking thing on the site, but not many, because not many people have registered. Because why would you? We've had several reported via Matrix. There's an HPR channel on Matrix, hash HPR, and that's pretty easy to connect with and send in stuff.
Can I just acknowledge what's Matrix?
It's a social, I guess you'd say it's a social networking thing, but it's meant to be something that is capable of interfacing. It provides a messaging interface like WhatsApp and whatever. But it also has got gateways to other networking, to other social networking systems. At the moment, we have a chat. We've got several channels set up, which we've set up. Although you can just set a channel up by yourself if you want to. We've got several channels, but one of them is called Hash HPR, and it's where HPR people post stuff, ask questions, chit chat. I occasionally post the weather in Edinburgh because Archer72 posts the weather in, I forgot where he is now, Kentucky, I think, isn't it?
Wow.
And so we ping pong the weather map, weather details, just for amusement. But we had some, I can't remember who it was, who sent in a message on there saying there's a problem with XYZ. And I simply copied that text into the issue system. And this morning, I got one on Mastodon, where a guy was commenting on a problem there. So I was able to point him to.
Is a reference to Mastodon and Matrix? I presume that's on the. There's a link to it on the main HPR website.
It was one of the things that we hadn't done, and people pointed out we hadn't done. But there's a Mastodon. I'm on Mastodon. There is an account on Mastodon called @HPR or something.
All right.
And
I guess as long as all these are referenced in the main HPR site, then, because I must admit, I just tend to look at the HPR site myself.
You don't have to be.
No.
I just happen to be on Mastodon.
That's interesting.
And I'm following various things, and I spotted user commenting on something, saying that there seemed to be something wrong with this one of the series.
So many avenues you can get input from, I suppose. That's the thing, isn't
we don't want to go in. We did mention some of this yesterday on the community news, we don't want to be repeating ourselves too much. But by the time this show gets put together, it'll probably be a couple of weeks then.
So people have forgotten us, of course.
So we're doing a service. We're doing a service.
Absolutely.
Not really repeating ourselves at all.
No, at all.
So
I don't know.
Quickly look at YouTube-y things.
Yeah,
I want to look at a YouTube.
Yeah. there's video and audio I was maybe wanting to talk about. So the couple of things. Mm-hmm. First was it was recommended by yourself. It was Little Chinese Everywhere. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you describe it, but it's been really, really enjoying it. It's fantastic, you know. And,
yes, yes. So
how would you describe it then?
It's a ex-student, and she has got a degree in, I think, sort of geographical related subject, and she got her degree in Switzerland, but she's from China, so she speaks English really well. She decided that rather than, you know, catch a plane back home, she would travel overland from Switzerland to China. Mm-hmm. So the first set of videos is about that journey. Oh. And then having got back to, I can't remember where she lives, Beijing, is it? I'm not sure. She decides that she wants to carry on doing this by visiting every province in China.
That's the current stuff.
Oh, and yeah, she has a skill of interacting with people and being very enthusiastic about what's there to be seen and showing it in an excellent way. She just is amazingly entertaining.
Yeah, yeah.
And that whole business of meeting people in other countries is such a fascinating thing. I think.
Oh yeah, I've been glued to it. You know, it's. I think we've watched 10 of them so far, I think. So.
I know. It's one of those that you can't stop.
Can't put down, that's right.
That's right, yeah. Good.
If you want, well, I'll just quickly cover my remaining thing. So I've been listening to, of course, it's, I don't know, for the American audience, how relevant it is, although there's always means and ways, as you understand. But the BBC do a series, was back in the day, it was called Computing Britain, hosted by Hannah Fry. And it looks back over the 75 years of computing history to reveal the UK's lead role in developing technologies we rely on today. So it's just fascinating. I mean, it talks about all sorts of stuff. The random number generator that they used for premium bonds back in the day, which was a way to encourage people to save, but then the church thought it was gambling. I thought it was the most evil thing possible, and you know, they have to find a way of developing of coming up with random numbers to pick the ticket, and it had to be truly random and not be able to nobble and whatnot. And then it talks about the very early computing that was done by, was it the Lloyd Tea Company? The tea chain, it was the
Lions.
Lions, wasn't it? The Lions in London. And they had so many shops that they couldn't keep track of inventory and all that. So they were out of desperation, they built their own computer. I mean, you know, a tea shop building a computer is just nuts, you know. But nobody had done it before, and so they were so far ahead of the game, and it took many, many years for anybody to catch up with them. But it ran all the stock controls and everything. But the history is just fascinating. It talks about the early computer days with the BBC computer and the Spectrum and all this sort of stuff, and it goes right through right up to present day, I think. So it's really, I would recommend listening to.
I've not actually heard of it. I've got a list of things here, which I've just sort of a bucket of things that might be of interest, which I'll just dip into and tell you about maybe two. I used to cycle a lot. I would quite like to get back into cycling. I might buy myself an electric bike, I'm not sure. And my first YouTube channel is called Not Just Bikes, and it's a guy who cycles a lot, and he's also interested in city design, or in fact the wrong way and the right way to design cities.
I've actually watched some of those and are fascinating, because they just show you how the terrible designs of some other. I don't want to say too much. You've got to watch it. It's incredible. But I would never think about the subtleties of what you've seen until
you start looking at the way the places function.
Yeah,
he's a Canadian, and he he was brought up in what he calls Fake London. So it's London, Ontario, I think, is the London he's talking about. But it's a bit of a joke. But he hated living there because it's so car-centric. And he'd been around various parts of the world and stuff. He's got kids, and he's married, and everybody's keen on cycling. And he and the family have moved to Amsterdam. And he makes a particular point of showing how Amsterdam and the Netherlands in general are much better designed for people to live.
People-centric rather than car-centric.
Exactly. And, you know, the cycling infrastructure and so on is great.
Yeah.
And the philosophy behind it, how it's being changed to be more, less car-centric and more bike and walk and pedestrian-centric. Yeah. And I did note the latest episode I'd seen, maybe it's not the latest one on the channel, but the title is Even Small Towns Are Great Here. And this is 5 years in the Netherlands. So he's been there five years. Wow. And he goes around various other towns, not just Amsterdam, but some of the other places, just to show what life is like.
As you get fewer cars, you get more people, and it's more compact. There's more to see and do. Yep. And it's
about how you structure your living spaces. Yep. You know, if you go through many of these smaller towns and Amsterdam itself, it's all about medium high-rise buildings with a lot of people in them and shops underneath, in many cases, or shops very, very close by. So you can walk to shops to buy whatever you need. You can cycle to them. If you need to go to IKEA, well, yes, you can do that. And you can hire a bike that's got the capacity to carry stuff.
I was amazed when people in the States, maybe just that can't, maybe some people in them won't understand how alien it was. I could not believe that a colleague of mine, he was over in Texas. Now this must have been about 30 odd years ago or something it was, and he was saying how going to the supermarket, and it's like a bloody motorway into the shops, nowhere to walk whatsoever. So you couldn't walk into the shop. You had to get a car on this motorway, it was like a 3 or 4 lane motorway into the shop. Mm-hmm. You know, not passing by the shop, but actually into the shop with no pavements. Are you nuts? You know, I can't believe that. You know, it's just
hell.
But then you can see some of the shops, some of the big shops, Tesco's and such, like others are available for impartiality. But I mean, even those, you know, the car parks are so busy and it's difficult to walk. But that's nothing compared to a bloody motorway up to the shop. I mean, that's just,
no,
can't imagine that.
The UK is sort of has been moving over the years more towards an American style of stuff.
I would say so.
A lot of Europe hasn't. It's definitely against that philosophy. And you know, I think there was a survey of the happiest people in the world or something like that. And I think the Netherlands scored very, very high. I think Scandinavia also scored pretty high. But there's a certain amount of cycling there. I'm not sure how much. But I think the Netherlands are excellent.
Yeah. Believe it or not, I meant to say to you when we're in having our meal, because we touched on cycling and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And so I did a tiny bit of cycling, but my bicycle has been sitting in the shed for many years. My wife already sold hers. So we got two bikes, and we tried to get a thing to put in the back. Well, first of all, we tried to cycle in a bit. Everywhere was hills everywhere, so we couldn't cope. So then we got a thing on the back of the car, and it was so much hassle to put it back often on the car that we stopped that. So then we thought, right, we'll try and get a really good quality one, and you can get this, I think it might have been a Swedish or some fancy design thing, and it's supposed to just drop onto the car. And yes, it was easier than the other one, but it was still a pain, and we got fed up doing that. So it ended up just sitting in the shed. My wife sold hers. Mine sat for years. And just this weekend, bizarrely, some friends of ours came and there you go, you can have the bike. Well, they actually gave us some money for it, but I mean, I would have given up kayaking for that. I was just gathering dust, you know. So, So, yes, I'm bikeless now. So, just 2 feet now. We do a lot of walking, though, so that's...
Well, yes, that's good. We used to cycle as a family a fair bit. Mm. I mean, both my kids had bikes, and I've had bikes. And when I was married, my wife had a bike, which she used a bit. But, I used to cycle to and from work, but I only live about a mile away from my work. But it's hilly.
It's a hilly, right?
But there's also an old fieldside trackway that I used to use, so it would be nice to go down there, or not quite so nice coming back up in the after work.
I could definitely see the because I was just saying to my wife, you know, if we didn't have a four-legged companion, then an electric bike would be the ideal solution, because you can flatten out the hills with that. Yep. You know, you still have to pedal the whole time, but just that would be the way to go.
There's quite a you do see them around. They're quite around. There's quite a number of them around here in Edinburgh. But Edinburgh's quite hilly, so I can understand that less appealing here.
And many years ago I was in Amsterdam and we had a set of bikes and I couldn't believe how, because we're running out of time, because, oh my God, look at time, we've only got so long to get back. And we travel a huge distance. That was so effortless because it was so flat.
And it's also geared up for bikes well. I've been to Amsterdam a few times. Yeah. I drove there once, went there for a conference, and my boss, and he'd hired a car, even though we weren't that far away from the venue we were at, from the hotel. Anyway, he hired a car, and we all went to the conference-y thing, and then he said, right, you could go now, and could you take the car back to the hotel? So I suddenly got this car in this foreign city, which I was licensed to do and everything, but
stressful
because it's trams, because there's car bits, there's bike bits, there's different lights for bikes, there's pedestrian bits. Mm-hmm. It's quite scary for somebody who's not experienced it before, but once you got used to it, it's so really well designed. It's beautifully designed.
Right.
My second, I'll just say quickly second one, because most of the details will be in the notes anyway, is another cycling in the Netherlands channel. I thought I'd lump them together. This guy is called, channel is called Bicycle Dutch, and the guy is Dutch.
Okay.
And he does videos. He talks about the cycling things. He talks about developments in cycling routes and stuff. He's done a series where he shows, he doesn't live in Amsterdam, he lives Hagenbosch or something like that. Mm. And anyway, he did a series where about 10 years ago he cycled the routes into town from the sort of suburban areas, and he filmed them, and then he's done the same route again, and then he's interleaved the two films. So he's got a picture in picture of the old one with the current one, and to show how it's changed and how it's improved. And so forth. So and I just find that you probably would not want to watch it, because it's just watching a guy cycling along the street from his viewpoint. But I find it fascinating because I just pick up on all the things. What are you supposed to do here? Can you cross? Can you turn with the lights? Are the lights against you or against the cars? The conclusion I draw is that it would be, you'd take a little while to get used to it if you went there with a bike, but you'd soon settle in and you'd find it was so forgiving and so pleasant to ride.
I mean, traffic in around Edinburgh is just a nightmare. It's just dreadful.
Yeah, Edinburgh traffic's not good. I have not cycled much in town.
No.
I did at one point. When I first came here, I worked in the centre of town in the grass market, and I brought a bike with me from my previous job, and I would cycle from the outskirts into central Edinburgh, and I was very fast, faster than the bus, and definitely faster than any car.
Well, my colleague used to cycle home, and my journey to work's 20 miles. I go along the bypass and whatnot, and he would go through the centre town. And I don't think he got home before me, but it was close.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes he was only a short time after me, you know.
Yep.
But I mean, yeah, 40-mile round trip, that's it. Must be super fit. I don't know how they could do that, you know. And all the hills I've got down here is just nightmare.
Yeah,
you know,
it was hilly the way I went in. I was used to cycling in Lancaster, where I was before, which is also fairly hilly in places anyway. Yeah. So
it's funny, you know, a lot of car drivers can get, surprisingly many car drivers can get very irate with cyclists, and I just don't get it, because, and I'm not a cyclist, but, you know, I get frustrated being stuck behind a lorry or something like that, or a bus or whatever, because you can't get past the damn thing, and it stops every opportunity possible. It'll stop or crawl or whatever, you know. But basically, you're only stuck behind them for a very short time, and you're past. They're easy to pass, you know. I don't see what the issue is.
That frustration I've never fully understood. Having been a cyclist first and then a car driver later, I suppose I was a bit more forgiving. I was a motorcyclist too at some various points. But makes you a little bit more appreciative of what's going on.
Yeah.
Anyway, so did you have any more YouTube-y things you wanted to?
I don't think so, because I've maybe had other things, but I think maybe they'll be
probably enough.
Maybe for another time. I think so.
I did too. It was greedy.
Yeah.
No, and I waffled a bit.
Well, I lumped two together, so I was the same. So.
Yeah. Good. Anyway, I think hopefully that will be of interest.
It's quite a long one as well. That 1 hour, 17 minutes.
Yeah, hopefully we can trim things down a wee bit.
Yeah.
So, all right then. So that's our
wonderful again
latest episode
and
wrapping up.
Yeah.
And Thank you very much.
Till next time, everybody, and it's a pleasure always. And keep sending in shows. We always need shows.
Absolutely. It won't survive unless we have them. So,
Cheers for now, then.
Yeah. Okay. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. Today's show was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hosting for HPR has been kindly provided by anhonesthost.com, the Internet Archive, and rsync.net. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 International License.